Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 291, we are back with the Traditional Journal Club. I'm joined by Dr. Safa Rahmani and Dr. Peter Tang to discuss three recent publications in major ophthalmology journals. First, we discuss patient perceptions of seeking urgent ophthalmology and retina care during the COVID-19 pandemic. Next, we transition into an article looking at the number of vitreoretinal procedures performed during the pandemic and how that changed compared to prior years. And finally, we finish with an article looking at reimbursements for ophthalmic procedures and their trend over the last decade. As always, you can find a list of financial disclosures relevant for the contributors in the episode description. You can also find a link to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a Traditional Journal Club, and I'm happy to be joined by two retinal surgeons from across the country. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Safa Rahmani from Northwestern University and Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. Safa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And last but not least, Dr. Peter Tang, who is in Minneapolis, Minnesota as a member of Vitreoretinal Surgery, PLLC. Peter, welcome.
Thanks, Jay. First time, long time. Happy to be here.
So I'm glad to have you both on. It's both your first journal club, and it's going to be a fantastic episode. So let's talk about a couple of these articles. So the first article we're going to talk about is relevant to the recent pandemic and the ongoing pandemic. The title is Patient Perception of SARS-CoV-2 Exposure Risk and Association with Continuity of Ophthalmic Care. This is by Aaron Lindeke-Myers et al. Aaron, terrific applicant this year from Emory University, I believe, who matched at Duke University, but I have to cross-check that. But well done, Aaron and team. Safa, you want to tell us a little bit about this article and what the author showed?
Yes. So this is a great paper that came out of Emory and University of Michigan. It was a collaborative effort that really focused on patient perspectives when it comes to the pandemic. And they started by really giving the reason why they decided to look at this is because there's been an alarming trend of patients really not attending these appointments, time-sensitive appointments by their clinicians during the pandemic. And actually for ophthalmology, we had a 79% outpatient eye care center decline, which was the largest in any specialty during the first few months of the pandemic. Obviously it's rebounded, but they felt that this was a very important topic to sort of delve into a little bit more because we keep talking about the clinical aspect of why patients don't show up, but we don't really take their perceptions as to why they're not showing up. So this is a study that they focused on with in terms of follow-up during the early months of the pandemic. The study really focused on AMD and diabetic retinopathy because of the importance of timed injections and follow-up, and really focused on those two when they were doing their study. So what they did was it was a survey that they did for they did a non-validated telephone survey of the patient population. So what they did is they looked at both Emory and University of Michigan. They went through and this looked at the records of about more than 1,000 patients that had appointments between the first 3 months of 2020, so January to March 13th, and then looked at how many of those were required to come for injections between March and May, again, during the peak of the pandemic, and then decided to call those patients and follow up those patients. They focused again on AMD with a 2-to-1 ratio and really wanted to know what was the follow-up and the people that did not show up, could we figure out sort of the reason why? And this was a 13-item telephone survey that was very well crafted and really focused on really, you know, what was the concern for the COVID-19, the degree of concern, the employment status of the patients. They really focus on multiple different reasons as to the questions, so they could really delve into what's going on with the patients. So when they called the patients, between May and really August. So May to June was for Emory and June to August for Michigan. And they really focused on the basic demographic information and really what we thought would be important for loss to follow up, which is how severe are their COVID-19 risk factors, and really what else can be, you know, can we look into in terms of what these patients' perspective was in terms of why they did show up or not show up. So they defined really the loss to follow up were people who did not show up for a visit within 14 days of when they were supposed to. And if the clinician canceled their appointment, they didn't count that as the loss to follow up. So this needed to be patient initiated loss to follow up. And they did a descriptive statistics, and they basically use a Likert response assay, which basically broke down all their questionnaires into, you know, easy 5 points in terms of likely, moderate, somewhat, and slightly, and not at all. And basically looked at all these factors in terms of what will be considered statistically significant in terms of what the patient's perception was. So I'll just kind of jump into the results. So they had about 1,000 patients that were eligible, and about 82% of the 400 that they were able to call were able to be part of the study. So about 238 patients for the AMD and about 110 for the diabetic retinopathy were able to be called. What's interesting is that if you look at the demographics, they're a little bit different. There was a preponderance for the white participants from Kellogg and even still with Emory, but overall they got a pretty good base comparison between the two sites. So what they found was that basically the risks for what the patients were willing to take really depended on first the diagnosis. So if they had diabetic retinopathy rather than AMD, they were much more likely to not show up. If they were white, if they were an older age, and if they were poor self-reported health overall, these were increased odds of loss to follow up. Whereas if they said that they lived independently, that was actually only decrease in terms of odds for loss for follow up. So and then they broke it down to Black and Latino patients that they had. And in that group, they found that the odds adjusted ratio for the Black and Latino groups to not show up was actually was 2. There was a much more higher preponderance of the Black and Latinos not showing up for their appointments. So in terms of discussion and what they found, this was really interesting. You know, basically they said that these patients, there was about overall 22% loss to follow up overall when we considered everything. And even in the AMD patients, the highest risk was still in diabetic retinopathy patients. And this was all perceived from the patients in terms of what they were willing to take risk with and whatnot, and what they were not. And I thought this was a very well done survey, even at different sites with different demographics. And we can kind of discuss a little bit in terms of all the details once we have a good discussion.
Great, great, great summary. And I think there's a lot to unpack here. This is fascinating and really relevant as we, again, maybe it's better, especially with vaccination becoming more widespread, but we may see waves of this pandemic in the future. And it's important for defining not only public policy, but kind of our strategies as healthcare professionals are going to drive a lot of the treatment plans and policies. You know, Peter, when you read this paper, any sort of things that jumped out to you or things that you wanted to comment on initially? I think we all have kind of initial reactions when we read a paper or read the results. What was kind of the most striking thing to you?
I think the 22% loss of follow-up was fascinating, just because when you look at the factors that they broke down as factors that led to more likelihood of loss of follow-up, certainly a diagnosis of diabetic retinopathy more likely than AMD, which I thought was kind of interesting. They thought here, they also said white race ethnicity was more likely as well, which actually is kind of interesting because if you contrast that with what you alluded to earlier on, you know, this is kind of like a very interesting pivotal paper that can segue into other questions about things like vaccine hesitancy and things like that. There's actually more hesitancy within minority populations within this country. You know, there was a paper that the CDC put out, was the Dr. Singleton's group put out back in February, where they did conducted a similar survey in September of 2020. And they actually found that the hesitancy for vaccination was actually highest among non-Hispanic Black adults at 56.1%. But here, you know, if you correlate here, there's actually white, elderly white patients were more likely to be lost to follow, which is kind of interesting how there's a contrast between the two. And you can sort of, in my head, I correlate that with how our perceptions about COVID and how scary it is and things that we do and don't understand about the virus, how that changes and evolves over time. And of course, this paper was looking at patients at two different time points. And of course, you're capturing, you know, a survey captures something within the moment. But when you actually look retrospectively at this past year, even our personal perceptions of what is safe, what is not safe has evolved. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it's important, I think, to comment on limitations for any study. Safa, you referenced some of the limitations. Obviously, it's a phone-based study. It's a survey study. Those are automatic kind of limiting factors. The timing of the study we talked about is not aligned, essentially, with shutdowns locally in those states, although it was still within a window where it made sense to conduct the survey. There is going to be some differences in responses. And Peter, we referenced kind of that difference in follow-up. The vast, vast majority of the patients responding, Safa talked about, are Caucasian or white. Ethnicity or self-reporting is that. So the question is, within that, are we getting skew at all in terms of what patients are able to or willing to complete the survey? Are we getting skew in terms of maybe people who are Black, Latino, who are completing the survey are different than the general Black and Latino population who may just not even complete the survey at all? So it's hard to draw a lot of conclusions from that, but it is a really fascinating point. Safa, in terms of other things, you know, I think the other thing that you referenced was the diabetic retinopathy AMD difference. That's been reported in other studies,
right?
That diabetics tend to have a lower adherence to follow-up regimens than AMD. That certainly aligns here with what we
Absolutely.
Saw.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, in terms of like, if we think about solutions, right? So let's say we're in another scenario where we do have a shutdown, something like that. Would this change kind of your policy or internal policy for how to handle these patients? I mean, what did you guys do for these types of patients during the pandemic? For example, here, I mean, we had to cut down our volume significantly to be compliant with social distancing and also be intelligent in terms of assignment of resources. One of the things that, you know, we each did individually as providers, kind of go through our patient list and kind of choose the patients who really needed to come in for treatment and call those patients to come in while canceling less urgent kind of routine follow-up patients. But it seems like we may have to redirect more energy towards potentially diabetic patients or even some of our AMD patients to get them to come in. Any sort of things that come to mind in terms of the differences or what you would do differently if, again, we're in a situation where we're shut down?
Right. I think an important point that this paper made was really, you know, not focusing on the clinical aspect as much as everything that goes with the patient perception. So, you know, having signs everywhere in clinic, having, you know, wash, you know, areas where they can clean their hands, and the perception of taking the CDC guidelines, I think is really something that I took away. Paper that needs to be added to us telling the patient, no, you have to come in, you know, really sort of discussing their fears head on rather than assuming that they're getting their information from the right sources, really being, you know, open about this is what the clinic is doing for optimizing ventilation, universal masking, physical distancing, and really making all those very visible and very open to the patient, which is, I think, we sort of take for granted when we, you know, go to a restaurant. They have all these signs, they have all these things that they point to what they're doing to make, you know, our experience safe. And I feel like at least in a, as a whole in our clinic, we didn't make it known to the patients, like, look, this is what we're doing. I think we sort of assumed they would know we would take the best care not to transmit the disease, but I think sort of being open with signs and discussion openly with them actively could go a long way in terms of really mitigating their fears for coming in, you know, really expressing that head on.
Peter, any final thoughts on this paper? I think we've hit a lot of the high points. I think the only other thing that kind of stood out to me was it's just fascinating always to look at differences between Emory and Michigan, obviously very different demographics between Ann Arbor and Atlanta. And I also wonder if the study results would have been influenced if this was from a non-academic center or more practice in the community. You know, these tend to be tertiary referral centers. And I wonder if the adherence of these patients is even inflated beyond what you would see in the community.
And certainly even considering the socioeconomics of it, having, you know, whether or not these diabetic retinopathy patients were mostly, you know, clustered within a hospital like Grady Memorial compared to the more university clinic. I mean, I think demographics has a huge part of this whole analysis. And certainly they touch upon it. It's kind of like underlying foundation to a lot of the findings that they discuss. And it would be very interesting to kind of have a second paper later on that kind of looks at that more directly.
Great. So let's transition to our next paper. And this is kind of keeping in the theme related to COVID-19, but this is more focusing on retina specifically. So the title of this paper is Frequency of Urgent or Emergent Vitreoretinal Surgical Procedures in the United States During the COVID-19 Pandemic. This was published online the last month in JAMA Ophthalmology by Breziano et al. Long list of authors who came together to put together this paper from multiple sites. Peter, you want to tell us a little bit about this paper and what they showed?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is Mark Breziano is the lead author. He's currently at Wilmer. He formerly was a fellow at Columbia. And of course, Stanley Chang is a senior author. But I mean, you look at the author list, it is a who's who in retina and a lot of big names, a lot of friends of the pod on this list of authors. But the objective here was to evaluate how COVID-19 pandemic affected urgent and emergent ophthalmic surgical procedures across the United States. And so for the methods of how they did that, you know, one of the key questions was, how do you determine when COVID-19 actually began? Because in the United States, different states actually implemented stay-at-home orders. I mean, as an example, Minnesota was March 27th, where I'm at. Florida was April 3rd. Illinois was March 21st. So there's so much variability, whereas the WHO declared it, I think it was like the 9th or 8th of March. So they settled upon the first U.S. territory or first U.S. Area that declared stay-at-home orders, which is March 16th, and that was Puerto Rico. And so they used that as kind of like a line in the sand to look at before and after. They looked at the frequency of the 11 different CPT codes, current practice procedural terminology codes, that were billed between January 1st, 2019 and May 31st, 2020. And these CPT codes were selected based on four different categories. First category is intravitreal injections, so that's 67028. Then you had in-office procedures like lasers and cryotherapy, prophylactic laser for retinal tears and detachments and lattice, that's 67141, 67145, 67228. And of course, then you had retinal detachment repairs, surgical repairs, you know, so primary buckles, vits, which also includes buckle vits. And they actually included complex RDs and pneumatic retinopexy, which is, you know, still a procedural, maybe not in the OR. And of course, other vitrectomies, straight vitrectomy, vitrectomy with laser, vitrectomy PRP. So they looked at those four categories. They compared time matched weeks between between when the pandemic was happening, as well as the concurrent weeks during 2019, when things were quote unquote normal. They also did sub-analyses looking at whether or not there's any variability in the numbers between regions, so the Northeast, Midwest, South, and the West Coast, because there were 17 different institutions within the United States that were contributing numbers to the study, and they were all scattered throughout. So it was a very interesting look at whether or not different parts of the country had different variability. They also looked at practice setting, so academic versus private, and see whether or not there's any kind of variability there. And of course, They also kind of did an analysis to look at whether or not a state implemented stay-at-home order at different days also had an impact on the numbers. One thing that I think would be important to point out is that for the statistics, they actually looked at the concurrent weeks in 2020, each week in 2020, against a averaged week per month in 2019. I think this is just to try to reduce some of the noise and have 2019 as kind of a smoother foundation for which to actually really look at how the variability in 2020 was. And so to get into the results, you know, we look at injections and then we look at other procedures and then a couple of other confounding factors to see whether or not they actually affected the numbers. So for injections, they actually found the greatest decline in intravitreal injections occurred in the month of April of 2020. And specifically April 6th to April 12th, that was the greatest amount of decline in injections. It was 38.6% decline. And then afterwards, beginning around May 4th to May 31st, that decline actually became statistically insignificant. So this is kind of an interesting finding that the injections, intravitreal injections within clinic, appear to have bounced back the quickest out of all the CPT codes that they looked at, which I suppose makes sense. And we could talk a little bit about that. Other procedures. So when they're looking at other procedures, the other CPT codes, all of them demonstrated significantly lower volume on average for each institution for each week in 2020 compared to 2019. And it still looked like April was the worst decline or the most decline for all of them. So 79.6% for lasers and cryotherapy, week of April 6th to 12th, 59.4% for RD repairs, April 13th to the 19th. And then 84.3% for all the vitrectomies, April 6th as well. Interestingly, they said that variability in the stay-at-home orders did not actually have a significant impact between the different CPT codes, between the different time points. The region, as well as the academic versus private group setting, also did not contribute any kind of significant difference within the numbers. So the conclusions, COVID-19 had a huge impact in the widespread reduction in urgent ophthalmic procedures, but it looks like the injections were the ones that bounced back the quickest, and it looked like by the second half of May, it came back to statistically insignificant differences compared to 2019. Mm-hmm. And then RD repairs also decreased during the COVID-19 pandemic, but it stayed down. So during the period of time that they're looking at the comparison of 2020 versus 2019, the RD repairs remained statistically reduced compared to 2019. And so they hypothesized, they postulated why that's the case, because some of the other medical fields like cardiology, neurosurgery, emergency medicine, they also saw a decline early on, but then there was a resurgence later on for some potentially latent demand. But retina didn't see that. And so so that's something that they postulate why that's the case, you know, and we could talk a little bit about that. But I thought this was a great paper, you know, one of the, and it brings up a lot of really interesting questions. I think it's a great jumping off point to a bunch of other interesting questions that people can ask about COVID-19, how it impacted our field. And, you know, so what do you guys think?
That's an awesome summary, and I think we can dive into all of those issues separately in a sec. I think limitation is always important. I think anytime you lump data from multiple sites and you reference the different dates, there's a little heterogeneity here that's going to make this data potentially a little weaker, although they did try to do sub-analyses and look at the geography separately. And I think stay-at-home orders don't always correlate with kind of the healthcare climate and mandates. I mean, I can't comment on all these places, but I can comment on Bascom-Palmer. I know the stay-at-home date they listed was April 3rd, which is correct, but I know that our institution was kind of closing down for only urgent procedures as of 2 weeks before that. So how does that kind of color the data? We don't know. And then, of course, there's other changes such as, you know, the coding, and they decided not to use certain codes like macular surgery, which was a whole separate issue discussed during the pandemic, was whether macular surgery is considered urgent or not. And we can get into that discussion as well if we have time. But before we get into any of that, so Safa, what are kind of your biggest reactions to this data in this paper? Anything specific you want to start as a jumping off point?
I think I think the most important kind of aspect of this is really the timing of when they looked at, you know, it's, for us, it was the same, you know, we went into, you know, sort of full shutdown a couple of weeks before the stay at home order, just like Bascom Palmer, where the system was shutting us down before even the stay at home order came. And just like the authors noticed, we didn't see really a big bounce back until many months after. And my thought is that a lot of these asymptomatic patients or patients that had minimal symptoms just stayed home for the few months, you know, especially when the authors were really looking, you know, between April, May, and June. And that some of those that did worsen may have showed up after with, you know, PVR and other worsening, which and we've discussed other papers that has shown that. So that's what I feel is really, you know, it's important to look at this, but I'm wondering if we had sort of, we track this all along, how that's going to, you know, sort of show whether we're going to see the same effect as neurosurgery and cardiology, because, you know, you can have a retinal detachment for a little bit before things get much worse.
Right. I mean, retinal detachments come, you guys know this better than I do, they come in all shapes and sizes, right? Like you can have a chronic inferior detachment in a young patient with a hyaloid down, and that can behave very differently than a bolus pseudophakic detachment in an older patient with liquid vitreous. I mean, in terms of how fast it progresses and how quickly that can affect vision. I think, Peter, you mentioned the injection part of it. It's interesting that it dipped but recovered. And I think one of the things, if we think back, those seems like a long time ago, it's been almost a year, right? But I think that practices adapted faster to figuring out creative ways to have patients feel safe and adapted for in-office procedures, rather than, we can get to talk about the ASC or hospital issue for OR access, but it seems like there was adaptations to that. You know, some practices had patients wait in the parking lot, call them in for their procedure. There was a lot more of injection only type visits, or kind of streamlining the process if it wasn't already streamlined, to get those patients in and out and get them their necessary treatment. It's not surprising there was a dip right in April, because that's around the time there's a combo of stay-at-home orders, but also just public perception, but I think practices quickly adapted and figured out creative ways to get patients in for those treatments. And I think surgery is a little more complicated. Software referenced hospital kind of regulations. It just depended on your OR access. I mean, I think some places you just could not do cases. Some places ASCs and ORs were converted to ICUs or converted to beds for COVID patients. Other places they were put on reserve for that. There were limitations in supplies. So that OR kind of taking a little longer to bounce back may be explained by that. It also just may be the nature of the type of patients who come in, right? So patients who know they need injections, see the loss in vision, maybe are more likely to come back in. This is going back to our first paper, maybe the AMD population, for example, versus patients with a retinal detachment. So if you just talked about it, maybe they just don't even realize they have a problem, because many more of them may be new patients and they don't recognize the symptoms. And so they just don't come in and get recognized and treated. But we don't know for sure, but this is some theories about what we're seeing here. I don't know if you have any thoughts, Peter.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the adaptability of the practices, I mean, certainly speaking from my own personal experience, having a full control, your own full control of the clinic and how you do things and the different policies you implement very quickly can definitely allow you to adapt to different situations, having patients with family members not coming in, but they can wait in the cars, you know, 6 feet apart, taking precautions for PPE, things like that, and help patients really feel comfortable. And so I'm not too shocked that the injections bounce back the quickest, whereas with the surgical repair, there's a lot more things at play. You got to talk to anesthesia. You got to talk to, you know, general anesthesia. There's a huge no-go in the beginning when there was still very little bit that's known about the virus. And now things have certainly adapted and changed. COVID-19 testing, you know, before surgery. And I thought it was kind of interesting. You know, I was looking at our own numbers at VRS and looking at, so their question that they had was, you know, they did not see surgical retina coming back to pre-COVID pandemic times. But then their analysis also ended in May, right? So I was actually looking at June onward. And I can tell you, and this is, of course, all just ancillary data from one practice, just looking at the numbers, not going through and filtering stuff out. But it looks like we actually, around the fall, went like 120 to 130% in our volume of surgical retina repairs. And it seems like we had more PVR too. And I think that's something that we're going to be digging into this more. But, you know, it's not like a unstable angina or NSTEMI, I mean, if you're not going to go into the hospital for that, right, you're going to go in eventually because that stuff is very serious. You know, if your one eye has decreased vision, maybe you sit on it for 6 weeks because it's not hurt. You got the other eye, you can still do things. And so maybe that's where the bounce back, the latent demand is much later, much later time frame for retina compared to something like cardiology or neurosurgery. It's a theory.
Yeah, I mean, Go ahead, Safa.
I would have to agree because I think, again, what brings the patients in, like Peter mentioned, you know, if you're having chest pain, that's been grilled into our, you know, our society that you must be seen and must be taken care of. And, you know, patients will be willing to take that risk to come in versus, oh, you know, I think I see something in my eye. Maybe it's a little hazier, you know, that hasn't been drilled into our, you know, society psyche that it could be vision threatening. And as Peter said, some people may just take that risk. Like, you know what? I don't know what it is, but it's not hurting me. It's not doing anything. We can check it out later and I'll just come back. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll just wait, you know, a few more weeks. And really with, in terms of the early pandemic, you know, we were all had no idea in terms of how this was going to turn out, how aggressive this virus was. You know, I don't think anybody wanted to be in the hospital setting any more than they needed to. So I think it all sort of contributed to everybody waiting until worst possible moment to come in to be seen. And I think it would be really interesting, like Peter mentioned, you know, they looked at this from, you know, May, you know, April, May, June, what happened June, July, August, and sort of every 3 month interval to kind of see what kind of bounce back those codes have. And I think we'll see a very different story, I would imagine.
And I think in the injections versus RD surgical repairs, I think maybe the underlying point is actually not the CPT codes, you know, injections bouncing back earlier versus RD repairs. It might be that the foundational difference between the two is established patients versus new patients, right? Because with these established patients, you're hitting them with an Amsler grid. You're telling them, check your vision monocularly every week. Make sure you call us if you have any increased distortion. So they are like great patients. I mean, my patients who have AMD, they're fantastic. They're on the ball, right? Whereas these new patients, they've never been to a retina clinic before. They probably never even had an eye exam before. And then they have new flashing lights, new floaters. They just don't understand that these are worrisome things. So I wonder if they took the numbers of RD repairs in their time frame, and they actually further broke it down to established patients who were coming in for injections anyway, or they already had an RD repair in the other eye, and they're more aware of the symptoms, whether or not there was actually any difference in those numbers compared to 2019 versus new unestablished patients, whether or not there was a decline. And I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's a single practice, but I think Mid-Atlantic and Philly looked at this and we talked about an article a few months back, but again, a lot of it was being driven by established patients versus new patients and new referrals kind of dipping. So I think that your theory is right, Peter, and be interesting to see data more corroborated. Or looking at the other way, it'd be interesting to see how many of these injection patients, was it their first injection versus their second, third, fourth, et cetera. I would bet you that a lot of these patients was not their first injection. There weren't that many new injection patients showing up at that point because they just weren't going through the referral channels. And I think the last point, you talked about the increase in volume and the bounce back. We have anecdotally definitely seen that. I think July and August and into that, it's been so busy since then, a lot more kind of chronic detachments, and also access to care varies, right? Like, so Safa's in Chicago, you're in Minnesota. You may have a little bit of Minnesota. I don't know how much you get in Chicago, but being in Miami, we have a lot of patients who travel from overseas. And a lot of them just simply couldn't fly here because their own countries have border control and boundaries where they can't go. And they just don't have retina care in their countries. I'm talking about Cayman Islands, Virgin Islands, a lot of the Caribbean, there just aren't retinal surgeons in these areas. And then if they're not allowed to fly or they don't have the means to afford a quarantine when they come home, then that really limits their ability to access care. And we're still seeing a lot of that spillover into this spring a year later. So anyway, we can continue this conversation. I just want to bring up this last article quickly. This is called Changes in Medicare Reimbursement for Commonly Performed Ophthalmic Procedures by Sriji Patel, friend of the program et al. Paul Sternberg was senior author in this paper. And just ensure I'll quickly fly through it. They just kind of review, if you look over the last decade, what's happened with a lot of ophthalmic procedures essentially declining. And every year, kind of these procedures getting cut and cut and cut. Some of these procedures, as much as 30%. all the way up to 46%. That's not even adjusting for inflation, where, you know, if you adjust for inflation, those cuts would be even more significant. And really, the reasons these have been cut is to try to achieve some budget neutrality, right? So CMS each year is trying to kind of balance and account for, again, healthcare expenditures, which is going to continue to rise at an exponential rate. And their argument, their discussion here is that this is not the correct way to kind of achieve budget neutrality, at least in the case of eye care. One of the ripple effects that will happen, is already starting to happen, is that certain procedures that are going to get cut, patient access to these procedures is going to decline. And that's paradoxically at a time where we have more and more patients who need vision-saving procedures. So I think, again, this is, I don't think there's going to be any disagreement that this is a complicated issue. When you, anytime you talk about healthcare expenditures, where does the money go? Where does the money come from? But I think the ripple effect aspect is important to keep in mind, because we're no longer in an era where, you know, 30, 40 years ago, a lot of patients are getting care at an academic center with extensive government or grant funding, and they're not so reliant necessarily on the reimbursement from their procedures. We're in an era that, regardless of whether you work in an academic center, which is now part of a greater hospital system, whether you're in a managed care organization, whether you're in a practice that's now owned by a private equity firm, or even if you get, if you're just in practice on your own, the economics and reality dictate that your behavior may be dictated, unfortunately, by your reimbursements. And that may influence the procedures you are able to book at your ASC or the procedures you are able to offer to some patients. And what happens to these patients if the reimbursement does not match the time, in terms of, you have one side, the CMS cuts coming, and on the other side, you have this push for greater efficiency, regardless of the practice setting you're in. So, Salpa, again, this is a complex issue, but any brief comments or comments on this paper?
You know, I agree with you. I think this is, you know, a very complex issue that, you know, who, you know, this, the whole neutrality of, you know, keeping the same for everybody in terms of where they're going to take money away and give it to which group, I think is very difficult to address. And I do worry, you know, I think based on these, you know, I think the access to, I mean, I see it in my own, at the Children's Hospital, already sort of over the past 5 years or so, because of all the cuts and all the changes to insurance, the Children's Hospital is only able to offer, you know, certain amounts of procedures or sort of care that they normally would not have needed to cut because of the reimbursements. And I do worry about how that's going to kind of affect long-term in terms of where the, and, you know, I'm in an academic center, and if, you know, we can't, you know, we're cutting different aspects of our care, like I do worry about how that's going to sort of affect us long term, because it just keeps getting, you know, cut more and more and more. And I do worry that, you know, people are not going to spend, you know, 10, 15 years of their lives training to become a neurosurgeon when, you know, they can't, for example, sort of get the same reimbursement to kind of cover all the costs that they used to be able to, like 10 or 20 years prior. And I think the same thing goes with ophthalmology. And I do worry about that. So this is a very complex issue that I think needs its own time and podcast. I think we can dedicate many hours to this discussion.
You could have a whole podcast channel just about episodes on this topic.
I think so.
Peter, you're welcome to do that. I mean, I will not do that.
I think Safa's absolutely right. There's a lot of philosophical questions that I think this paper brings up. I mean, a lot of the reason why there's a shift in cutting reimbursements here is to compensate for the increase in compensation for preventative medicine and for general practice, right? I mean, we're talking about going into an era of preventative medicine. If we can prevent diabetes from happening, we can extend life years, we can extend quality of life aggregates. And these are all very important important goals. And because of that, you know, because we are super subspecialized, you know, we are taking some of the hit for that. Which, you know, you can make a counter argument that if there's going to be less tractional retinal detachment because more people are getting better diabetic care, shouldn't we actually have increased reimbursements to compensate for the decrease in volume, right? But of course, it doesn't work that way. And so I think Shriji is absolutely right. I mean, the premise of the paper, the current system is just very, very involuted. And there has to be a better way to do this.
Oh, I think your perspective is so optimistic, Peter. And I don't think you're saying that's the most likely outcome, but a best case scenario. I mean, the likely unfortunate reality is you're probably not going to screen enough people to reduce the incidence of diabetic tractional detachments. In contrast, that incidence is going to continue to skyrocket. Like, again, this is anecdotal, but I staff, you know, one of our resident clinics here, and we take care of a lot of patients with diabetic retinopathy that's significant, severe, from a lower socioeconomic status. And I was just commenting to the residents the other week that, you know, compared to when I was a resident a decade ago, the number of patients with neovascular glaucoma seems to have risen. We're actually going to look at this now and see if that's actually true. But like, I think that diabetes, for example, is its own epidemic that's not as drastic as the COVID-19 pandemic, but may have humongous ripple effects that equal it over time in terms of costs and the loss of human quality of life and life. And one of the spillover effects to our field is blindness. And how are we going to kind of compensate for that in an era where you're right, and they're talking about, if you're not incentivized to take patients to surgery and you're incentivized to treat patients currently, for example, in a reimbursement model right now, where it may make sense in certain practices or systems that you're better off treating a patient with anti-VEGF than surgery. And for sure, anti-VEGF reimburses better than surgery, and anti-VEGF is less invasive, but it's not necessarily always the medically correct option for every patient. It's probably better that we have some individualization so you can tailor it to the patient you like. And I obviously those things will change, and the dynamics of anti-VEGF and other treatments will change. But the real question is, if you start really hammering surgeries that take longer by decreasing their reimbursement, the access issue becomes a problem. And if you're an ASC that's trying to turn a profit, are you going to let Dr. Peter Tang or Dr. Safra Amani book a 2-hour TRD when you can book other outpatient procedures that take 15 to 20 minutes each and make a significantly higher revenue stream and not use as much equipment that costs money?
I mean, I think I absolutely agree with you, Jay, and your earlier comment about how this actually changes our practice pattern, I think, is something that's worth at least spending 30 seconds on. You know, and I'm going to say something very controversial. Ready for it? I think that, you know, a lot of people, when they do retinal detachments, you know, there's definitely two camps. There's the camp that is, do not do a buckle. A vit can solve most of your problems, and most people just do primary vitrectomies. Whereas the second group of people would say, a buckle vit or a primary buckle would be just as effective with less complications and less redetachment rates. And unfortunately, I mean, I've seen this in training. I think there's less and less fellows coming out of training doing buckle vits, doing primary buckles. I think it's an art that's actually gone down. And you know, we can have that argument about, you know, what is appropriate for a buckle, what is not appropriate for a buckle, but you cannot get away from the fact that a buckle vit reimburses as a vit, right? And therefore, if you're not getting paid extra to put a buckle on and taking the time and planning the procedure out, unfortunately, a lot of people may not be motivated to do one, which is unfortunate. I mean, the other question is, you know, protocol S, right? PRP versus anti-VEGF injection. And which is faster, which, you know, and that's something that you also have to consider. Is protocol S can be as effective, but is it right for the right patient? Because you have to select patients very carefully. They have to have good follow-up. And so protocol S kind of comes into this question too. You know, are the changing reimbursement landscape affecting the way we practice medicine?
Yeah, I feel like I agree, obviously. I feel like we're going to turn into a meme because every single episode, regardless of the topic, turns into a conversation about how people should be buckling more. I'm the old man yelling at the fellows to get off my lawn and go do some buckles. Safa, any final words before we break?
You know, I wanted to also mention, you know, I've had some discussions with non-surgical physician colleagues, you know, in terms of, you know, what happens with surgical reimbursement. And what's interesting, you know, from an outside perspective, who's, you know, they're like, well, you know, you're doing cataract surgery, retina surgery, just 10-minute procedure. How hard is it? Who cares if you guys are paying, you know, paid a little less, you know, and to kind of, you know, we sort of, our instrumentation and our surgical skills have improved so much over the past, you know, 30, 40 years, where cataract surgery is 10 minutes, you know, you can do a primary vitrectomy, probably, you know, and a good vitrectomy in like 30 minutes or 45 minutes. And those perceptions in terms of how fast we can do procedures, I think actually has a little bit shot us in the foot, because you know, somebody who doesn't know, it takes years and years of surgical training to get to the 10-minute cataract or the 30-minute vitrectomy, doesn't appreciate how much time has gone into that to make it 10 minutes. You know, so they turn around, you know, and say, oh, well, it just takes you 30 minutes. It just takes you 10 minutes, you know, to do X, Y, and Z of a surgical procedure. And, you know, the nuances of getting to that 10 minutes is very vast and very complex. And, you know, I feel that that discussion also needs to be, you know, sort of put on the table when all fields of medicine are discussing this, you know, oh, it's just a 10 minute cataract. That's easy, you know? So I think that's also an aspect that we, as our instrumentation gets better, I think needs to be addressed that yes, maybe it's a short procedure, but it takes years and years of, you know, practice and finesse to get to that point.
I think there's, Sava, I think you're absolutely right. I'm glad you brought up that point. I was, a few years ago, I listened to a talk from George Williams from Beaumont, because he sits on the, was that the medical board where they actually determine how much dollars are given for each CPT code. And that is exactly the argument and the conversations they're having in that board. They're talking about, hey, if you can do a cataract surgery in 6.5 minutes, and you can do 40 of them in a day when you have like 3 ORs, should we really be reimbursing that as much as, you know, another procedure in vascular surgery that's going to be 3 times as long? Because they do look at time as a factor. And of course, we have no idea what ENT, you know, how complex an ENT procedure or vascular surgery procedure is. But if they do it in 5 minutes, we assume that that is straightforward and easy.
Exactly.
Which is very, very wrong, right? And so I absolutely agree with you. I think it's a great point that you bring up.
Well, we are going to leave the listeners on that note and leave a lot of meat on the bone, but that is a conversation for another day. And we're happy to have that conversation, continue to have that conversation if people want to hear about it. But Dr. Sava Ramani, Dr. Peter Tang, thanks for going over time. Thanks for going over these articles in a group setting. It was fun. It was informative. And hopefully the listeners found it as educational as I did. So thank you guys.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jay. Have a good night.
As always, you can find this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com, RETINAPodcast.com. All 291 episodes are found there sorted by category. In addition, you will find links to subscribe and receive updates as new episodes release. You can also find us in the podcast applications on your Android or Apple device. We're also on Twitter and on Facebook at Retina Podcast. And to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Many thanks to Drs. Ramani and Tang for joining me for this episode. Thanks to Drs. Angela Chang, Louis Kai, and Mike Benacasa for their work on the editing and the production for these episodes. And thank you, listeners, for the articles you read and publish, the patients you take care of every day, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.